The thinking behind this was, well, some of you were part of the process, and thank you for coming to that lunchtime meeting. It was a while back. It was a feeling that we do Siurim, we lead the Beit Midrash a number of times during the year, and part of my job is to organize those programs, to suggest those programs, and be involved in organizing some which I inherited. And I'll be honest with you, I looked at the program and I thought of myself as a student, and I thought, we at Pardes hadn't yet dealt with somewhere which we call Har HaBayit, the Temple Mount. Truth is, even the name, and we're going to see one of the reasons I think why we haven't dealt with it, I don't mean this to be like critical of Pardes in any way, but I understand why we don't deal with it. It's very controversial, it's a very difficult issue, it's a very sensitive issue. I often say to Israelis when I guide, I even make them think about the term that they use. A secular Israeli, sometimes when I work with them, perhaps if they're part of a birthright group, even the term Har HaBayit, we translate into English the Temple Mount, there's a physical issue with the term. Neither the mountain we see today nor the temple, apart from that, it's a good name. But even secular Israelis who think about the term the Har HaBayit are using it automatically without considering sometimes like the name that we call something reflects a very deep connection or relationship to a place. So the thinking of Pardes went like this. I brought up the topic a while ago with David Bernstein and really took a lot of thinking about and talking about whether we can visit, not physically, partly physically, whether we can visit, whether we should visit, what we would need to do in order to make a visit possible. There's a certain irony in that it's so central to the Jewish historical memory. It's so central. It's one of it's called the foundation stone, but it's one of the foundations of our Jewish historical memory. Geographically, it's within a few hundred meters of the Beit Midrash, and it's like the one place that we haven't visited as Pardes for many, many years. Of course, I know why that's the case, but those who came to the lunchtime meeting, we tried to open that conversation to try to understand where you're coming from. The Pardes faculty here is also complex in terms of their different opinions and how they feel about it. I don't say this in an arrogant way, but I was happy to be part of that process of bringing up the topic. In the end, what we've done this year, and I'm not sure if it will be only this year or if it will be different in next year, is we decided that we're ready to do. I won't say what we're not ready to do. What we were ready to do is to have an afternoon iyun, a series of two main sessions looking at the topic of Har HaBayit. When we thought that we might go to Har HaBayit as a Beit Midrash, we kind of thought, what kind of preparatory afternoon would we do? We didn't think we'd just like say, let's meet at 7:30 and go. We always plan that we do some kind of preparation. I'm not sure that this afternoon is exactly what the preparation afternoon would have looked like if we'd gone to it. So we fell shy of calling this afternoon preparing for the Temple Mount visit, but we're not actually going to the Temple Mount. It might not look too dissimilar from what we're doing this afternoon. And so that's what we're going to do. So I'm going to start with a short political and historical overview. I'm going to go back in time. So we're going to talk about today, and then we're going to go back in time and see what we know and what other people know about the mountain that we call the Temple Mount, and then we'll turn to Meir Schweig, who's going to look at a more halakhic issue. We called it a halakhic primer. It's going to have practical concepts as well. Again, because we're not actually going to the Beit Midrash, to the Temple Mount, it might not have that level of details if we were going. But we'll see where we go with that as well. And we'll see what might happen in the future. How we move from here. Listen, when we got to the stage of talking about the whole process, when I first brought it up with David Bernstein, I don't think I'm giving you more background than I meant to, or that you might want to know. Last semester, if you remember, there was a very difficult time in Jerusalem. We had a series of piguim, like attacks on Jewish targets inside what's sometimes called West Jerusalem, and not always in West Jerusalem, and there were deaths as well. And so we felt we weren't ready to even prepare to think about going to the Temple Mount. Things seemed to quieten down, again, not 100%. And as we got closer to the end of the year, it occurred to us that Yom Yerushalayim is coming. And we always mark Yom Yerushalayim. It just seemed that this was a good slot, as it were, to take for Yom Yerushalayim. So this is our way of marking Yom Yerushalayim, I think, in a constructive efficient manner, like something worth doing. I hope you'll agree with me. Okay? So that's the background. I'm going to show you some slides. I'm happy to take questions as we go through, but don't be offended if I say I'm either going to come to that or let's talk about that at the end if there's time or something like that. But if I see a hand, I'm happy every now and then to take questions and make it a little bit of a discussion. Just for the record, that there are competing names. In Jerusalem, I guess there's two competing names, or three, if we add in the English, for the Temple Mount. So I'm going to refer to it as the Temple Mount or Har HaBayit, which is the Hebrew and the English names. Har HaBayit, which you mean the mountain of the Bayit, which refers to the temple. So the Temple Mount is the closest translation. Who speaks Arabic? What do Muslims refer to the basically the area we're looking at on the slide right now, the area of the old, inside the old city of today, the old city walls, of course, were not always the old city walls, but what the Muslims refer to it as? Haram al-Sharif. I don't speak Arabic, but I understand it means the noble sanctuary. Haram is a sanctuary. Haram al-Sharif is the noble sanctuary. So that's the reference. And we'll talk about the Islamic connection as well. When did the question really come up? And this is obviously the connection today. When did the question start to come up in a serious way about what our relationship is in a modern political sense to the area known as Temple Mount was, of course, after this day 47 years ago, 48 years ago. Only after the Temple Mount once again was in Jewish hands, Har HaBayit b'yadeinu, the Temple Mount is in our hands, were we able to have a practical conversation about what to do with the Temple Mount. And that was today, that was the third day of the Six-Day War. June the 7th, 1967, that the Temple Mount, remember, that was the first time that there was a Jewish flag flying over it for 2,000 years. If you imagine that in the year 70, when the second Jewish state was destroyed by the Romans, there was a Jewish flag or some whatever was used at the time, a flag flying over. So it took until 1967, almost 2,000 years, for a Jewish flag to be flying over the Temple Mount. Of course, that was the first time in 2,000 years. In some ways, as we're going to hear in a second, it may be the last time as well. Because very soon after the flag was hoisted, the Israeli flag was hoisted over the Temple Mount, Moshe Dayan ordered that it be taken down. And that's in some ways at the root of the status of the mountain today. And I want to therefore start the presentation by talking a little bit about what's the status of the mountain today, like under Israeli some kind of rule. Since 1967, it was part of a bigger question. If you look at the slide here, this is a picture from well before 1967. But here's the Western Wall that we're familiar with. You can see the area where the pointer is. The whole area around the Western Wall that isn't the plaza that we're familiar with today. The picture is from 1864. The what we call the plaza was definitely not a plaza, and it's not too dissimilar to what this area was looking like in 1967. When it was captured by Israel in the Six-Day War as well. Some of you are familiar with this area south of here. What's that called there? Those of you who have been here, that the pointer's on right now? Robinson's Arch. You can see the ground level here is just a few stones under sort of Robinson's Arch. We've cleared all of this area in a very 100 years later in an archaeological excavation. But going back to the plaza of the Western Wall, this is not, as I say, not too dissimilar to the view that was presented to our paratroopers, to Moshe Dayan, to Levi Eshkol in 1967 when Jerusalem was captured. And so the first question to realize, and we have to realize this, was it wasn't just what shall we do with the Temple Mount, Har HaBayit, but what shall we do with the area adjoining to it? It was like a package. We dealt with both at the same time. This is the package I received, and we had to make some very quick decisions in terms of what shall we do? What shall we do both with this area where Jews have now been praying since the Middle Ages, and what shall we do with this area where they prayed for 2,000 years to rebuild their temple and for the first time there's a Jewish flag flying there? And the person who really made some very quick decisions, and once you make a promise to someone, it's very hard to take that promise away, is Moshe Dayan. Moshe Dayan was the person who David spoke about this morning. He was the Minister of Defense. He's the nominal head of the war. He's in charge. The chief of staff, Yitzhak Rabin, is his... He's the boss. Moshe Dayan is the boss of the chief of staff. We're not a dictatorship or a military country. And so Moshe Dayan very quickly made some decisions. And many of those decisions are with us to this very day. Changing some of those decisions are very difficult. Moshe Dayan refers to it in his memoirs. I'll just read one or two things in his memoirs. He wrote, for example, the following. I thought that the first unequivocal decision that had to be made concerned the direction and supervision of the compound of the mosques and the Muslim offices. On the morning of the first Saturday after the war finished on a Saturday, June the 10th, so this is a week later, within 6 days, or 7 days if you like, I visited the El-Aqsa Mosque and met the Muslim religious personnel responsible for it. I reached the court of the mosque by way of the Western Wall. Access to the wall had been denied to Jews for the previous 19 years, and now as we passed it, thousands of Jewish worshippers crowded against its ancient stones in ecstatic celebration. let me go on a little bit. Before entering the mosque, I asked the Israeli officers who were with me to take off their clothes and leave their weapons behind them. After hearing explanations about the mosque and the customary arrangements for worshippers and visitors, I asked my hosts to talk of the future. At first, they refused. But when I sat down on the carpet and folded my legs, Arab fashion, they found it necessary to do the same, and inevitably, we engaged in talk. I said that the war was now over, and we had returned to normal life. I asked them to resume religious services in the mosque on the following Friday. I had said I had no wish and no intention of continuing the practice which the Jordanians had of censoring the Friday sermon before it was broadcast. I said that Israeli troops would be removed from the site and stationed outside the compound. The Israeli authorities were responsible for overall security, but we would not interfere in the private affairs of the Muslims responsible for their own sanctuaries. There were two Muslim places of worship, and they had the right to operate them myself. One more line. My host had no doubt that on the day we had captured this site, I had given orders that the Israeli flag be removed from the Mosque of the Dome where it had been hoisted. That's a very significant sentence. It's again, I'm going to try and be as balanced as I can. I know different people have different points of view. But thinking about the background of David's talk this morning about what the victory in 1967, or perceived victory in many ways still, again, okay, I'm being careful with it. In 1967, the flag that we flew, that we dreamed of flying a flag for 2,000 years over this, over what we remembered as the Temple Mount, we took it down immediately. And Moshe Dayan confirmed that with his Muslim hosts a week later. He says, it was me. I saw the flag up there and I told them to take it down. It sometimes when I work with people coming to Israel the first time, they say, why is there no Israeli flag flying over the Temple Mount? And there isn't one. To this very day, there's no Israeli flag flying over the Temple Mount. Again, changing anything back to decisions, promises that have been made is very difficult, and that's the subject of some controversy at the moment. The conversation between Moshe Dayan and his host, I'm not sure who was the host, to be honest, evolved into something called the status quo. And the status quo isn't a legal document, but it's a series of understandings which are held both by the Israeli government and by the Muslim authorities. And it's basically these six principles which dictate to this very day the political status quo on the Temple Mount. We won't read them all, but I'll point out the important ones. The first one is important, the Waqf, as an arm of the Jordanian ministry. The Jordanians, to this very day, the ultimate, they appoint the religious officials. Jordanian Ministry of Sacred Properties would continue to manage the site and be responsible for arrangements and for religious and civil affairs there. Essentially, that's the clause by which the site would remain a Muslim holy site, as it had been for 1,300 years. And that's a very central part of the status quo. So the religious authority would belong to the Muslims. In number four, it says Israeli sovereignty and law would be applied to the Temple Mount, as to the other parts of Jerusalem to which Israeli law was applied after the 6 day war. Make no mistake, the Temple Mount is part of Israeli sovereignty. But Moshe Dayan believed by exercising sovereignty on the Temple Mount didn't mean necessarily having a religious jurisdiction. And in fact, he was prepared to waive religious jurisdiction to the Muslim authorities. And that's more or less been the arrangement, or it has been the arrangement in place to this very day. Unless the demand of the Muslim authorities has been extreme, Israel has always acceded, because we're keeping to our side of the status quo, that the demand be met. The Muslims have asked for certain prayer times to be respected for no visits, if certain places should not be visited, essentially as a sign of respect to their religious authority. In order to keep to this agreement, we've kept it. It was clear we outlined very, number two I put in bold, because that's the source of much tension at the moment. Jews would not be permitted to pray on the Temple Mount, but they would be able to visit it. And that was very clear, that Muslim religious authorities had certain limits to the rights they could demand. The Jews should always be allowed to visit the Temple Mount, but we will already take on the restriction upon ourselves that we will not pray on the Temple Mount. And that's as much as I really can tell you about the political status quo on the Mount. There will be those on the right wing of the Israeli spectrum, and maybe it's unfair to call them right wing because you might claim it's fact, that some of the demands of the Muslim authorities have whittled down non-Muslim rights, and particularly Jewish rights on the Temple Mount. For example, times of visiting are now more restricted than they were in the past. You used to be able to visit on Shabbat, for example, Friday and Shabbat. Friday, I'm not sure, but Shabbat, 100%, you're able to visit. You used to be able to visit inside the buildings on the Temple, and the rule applies for anyone who's not a Muslim, but for Jews and non-Jews, but Jews, obviously, I think, have a certain stake in this, so you used to be able to visit. Has anyone visited inside the Golden Dome of the Rock itself, the Golden Dome? Before the law became stricter, which was in 2000, there was a number of years when the visits were closed completely, by the way, after 2000. One of the issues Israel's taken, and it was in the status quo, it doesn't seem like a big issue. It says, over the years, the raising of flags of any kind was prohibited on the mountain. One of the things that Israel has said is that was a restriction we took on ourselves in order that they would be clear that no Israeli flag would ever fly over the Temple Mount, at least without a tearing up of the status quo agreement. Again, this was signed literally in the hours after the Six-Day War. What one of the Jewish critiques of the status quo is that the other side haven't kept their deal. Because you do go up to the Temple Mount sometimes, you do see all kinds of flags on the Temple Mount, flung between lamp poles sometimes. Sometimes they're flags of organizations which are openly hostile to Israel's existence as well. And so Israel says it's not just the sovereign flag it refers to any kind of flag which shows, flags show sovereignty. That's the world we operate in, for better or for worse. And so that's the status quo agreement, and that would be important to know this, were you to visit the Temple Mount, in terms of going up. I'm going to move on from the status quo. Are there any questions up to now?
Sarah.
Are you going to talk about Moshe Dayan's motivation in agreeing to these six things?
I can try and sum it up as far as I understand it. Moshe Dayan, and this goes back to what we said before, saw it as a package, in that he believed that we were making certain, that the Muslims would make certain concessions, and there was very little fanfare when Israel basically demolished this neighborhood within also a few days of the Six-Day War. And Moshe Dayan saw it as a package. He also believed, and I think this refers actually very much to what David said this morning, as what I've read, because Moshe Dayan actually never wrote down his intentions. He believed that peace was imminent. A little bit like David said this morning, that the sense that our victory was so total over the Arab world. So why would we make a step that would be, in some ways, surely our reasonableness, our concessions in some ways, by not changing the status quo, in some ways would bring that peace nearer. Like he believed peace, I think, was really imminent, was almost immediate, so he wasn't in a change. I'm also not convinced he saw that a status quo, that the jotting down of some notes would have such force in the mindset of both Jews and Arabs, but Arabs who are in some ways don't control the power cards, as it were, that any attempt to change those is seen as red lines for them. So in fact, I'm not sure he realised that would be the force of these notes he jotted down. So there's just a couple of suggestions, and people have other suggestions, but that's my understanding it as well. There's a religious aspect, which we'll get to in a second as well, and I'm sure Mayor's going to touch on it more as well. Go ahead, yeah. Ask it loudly.
Was there an immediate response from the religious community when...
Yeah, he actually writes in his notes that very quickly, and we're going to see it in a second, that the ultra-Orthodox, who still have much of the balance of religious power, as they do today, very quickly were quick to outlaw visits to the Temple Mount. And that may have been a little bit behind Moshe Dayan's feelings, but he does mention this, a fascinating episode. He says this: a sticky problem cropped up on August the 16th. This day coincided with the ninth month of the Hebrew month of Av. You know, I won't go on. It says, Rabbi Shlomo Goren, the chief army chaplain, and several minyanim decided to pray that day on the Temple Mount. They brought with them a Torah, an Ark of the Law, and a pulpit. So there was actually a minyan on the Temple Mount on Tisha B'Av of 1967, in contravention of the status quo agreement, which was really a series of notes at that point. I learned about the incident only later through the military government's liaison officer, who had failed to prevent the rabbi and those with him from praying there. The matter came up for consideration by the government. The government then said, hang on a second, should we allow people? Although understandably no minister wished to take a formal position stating boldly that Jews were forbidden to pray on the Temple Mount, it was decided to maintain the current policy, which in fact banned them from doing so. It was evident that if we did not prevent Jews from praying in what was now a mosque compound, matters would get out of hand and lead to a religious clash. And that in some ways is the heart of some of the recent challenges, most recently in the most famous figure. Hang on, we'll come back to that in a second. The most famous figure associated with the challenge to the status quo is Yehuda Glick, and many of you have been here for the year will know the story, of course, that attempted assassination about 6 months ago outside the Begin Center here at the end of Emek Rafaim. He's one of those people most at the forefront of challenging the status quo. Someone here who's more legally in tune with things will tell me that a court recently ruled in his favor, that in principle there's nothing in Israeli law which prevents a Jew from praying on the Temple Mount. That he challenged it. He sued for damages against the police. And for the first time since the status quo agreement, it was just signed about eight, just issued about 8 weeks ago, a court issued there's nothing in principle There's no Israeli law. The status quo isn't a law, and there's nothing in principle to prevent a Jew from praying on the Temple Mount. They left it to the eyes of the police force to decide whether it would be endanger public security. And so you can see there's a little bit, and right now the new government which has been formed, there's one or two government ministers who are talking about legalizing Jewish prayer. Of course, it's not going to be something which is easy to convince the whole of the Knesset. It's not going to be something to convince everyone of the wisdom of it, and it's not going to be something which the Muslims are going to let go quietly. But there's a certain tension at the moment, and he's the name... I'm not saying he's the cause of the tension, of course that depends where your politics lie, but he's one of the main people behind challenging the status quo, which has come up in recent months. The thing we mentioned before is, those of you who have been up to the Temple Mount, this is an old sign, the new one it looks slightly different, but when you wait in the queue, where the non-Muslims go up to, you know where the queue is by the entrance to the Western Wall compound, by kind of near Robinson's Arch, there's a sign saying, according to the Torah, it is forbidden for any person to enter the area of the Temple Mount due to its sacredness. And that sign went up very quickly after the Six-Day War as well. So that may have helped Moshe Dayan make his decision. What's fascinating is today I've taken a picture a couple of times, I should have put it on the slide. The sign is there, and standing underneath the sign are 100 or 50, often young men with a kippah and their tzitzit out as well. And so The observant eye notes a kind of clash or an undermining of certain authorities in the country when the chief rabbinate has a sign saying it's forbidden to go here, and there's a whole line of people who clearly feel some kind of affinity to halakha and orthodox law who are queuing to go up to the Temple Mount as well. And that's a new phenomenon in recent years, which is very much a challenge in the eyes of the Muslims to the status quo. By the letter of the status quo, there's nothing wrong. As many Jews should be allowed to go up there as possible. The type of Jew who's visiting the Temple Mount, in the eyes of the Muslims, is somehow a breach of the status quo. And that's led to some of the tension. Only in the last decade, the Torah observant Jews have broken with the chief rabbinate. So the sign is still there, but it's fascinating. Go and watch one day and see how many people are making their way up to the Temple Mount who are clearly people who consider themselves halakhic Jews. I don't want to get into legal. In terms of legal terms, I don't have the authority or knowledge to answer that question. I understand there's a law in Israeli law called freedom of worship law. And when Yehuda Glick went to the courts, he said the status quo is an understanding. Is an understanding, it's part of an agreement between. You're right. It's part of an agreement between the Jordanian Waqf and between Israel. But he challenged its legality. Or if it is a law, then he challenged, I think, the legality of the law, using another law, which is a freedom of worship law, I think. So, but I'm happy to look into that more, if someone knows more about it as well. Go on, Lauren. Lady.
Can I just rejoin
that? Oh, yeah, he's a lawyer, here you go.
Just to add to the conversation,
yeah. It's
the same court that made the decision,
yeah,
that allowed women prayer groups at the Kotel.
Mm.
It's the same legally, not politically, but legally it's the same issue of freedom of worship and whether one group in Israel can restrict another group's worship in a certain site. And that's why, as Jamie correctly said, the court said the law is that they are allowed to, and notice I didn't say who's they. The court said it twice, once to Yehuda Glick and once to women at the war.
Lauren.
Maybe I can't come to the court as an aspect, both of you, to what extent does this also apply to the Kotel? Like, can a Muslim come?
Yeah.
Right.
I would imagine, in theory, yes. The question is, could a Jew go and have a minyan in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre then at that point? Like, how far do you take it? And so I don't know. I don't know what the courts would do to that. I don't know if the theoretical issue has ever come up. So I don't know, but I don't...
Okay, but in general, Muslims, yeah, are allowed to come to the Kotel?
You definitely see Muslims the whole time walking through the area of the Kotel. I think if a Muslim chose to pray in that area, they would probably be harassed by more extreme Jewish people, whether they legally have a right to pray there. I can't think of a reason why they would not be. I can't think of one.
The court did make a difference between inside a house of prayer and in an entire area. And that's one of the reasons why Damien correctly described that the court said that there needs to be an arrangement. In both cases, the court said you need to find an arrangement so that there's space for everybody to take. The court never said that they're allowed to have a minyan inside the Dome of the Rock, or that they're allowed to, or the women of the wall are allowed to pray exactly in the middle of the Ezrat Varim, in the men's section of the Kotel. The court said we just need to find a place because we believe in freedom of worship.
So if there are enough Muslims made the claim that the Western Wall, and it is holy to Muslims, for reasons which maybe we'll go into later, that they should have a prayer space there, then the court, I guess, would say, so you can see with the Temple Mount, you can see that there's two buildings, essentially, on the Temple Mount, the building known as the Dome of the Rock and the El Aqsa Mosque on the southern side, but the area of the Temple Mount, which is actually open space, is the vast, vast majority, and I think maybe that's what the court was referring to. We have to move on. I can see we're going to run out of time. I just want to finish with this issue because it's interesting. When the Israeli government in after 1967 tried to figure out the package deal, if this is a chance to like appease all the sides in terms of the Jewish sides and the Muslim sides as well, this was an interesting suggestion from a Likud Central Committee member. He proposed building a third temple above the site of the Western Wall Plaza. Does that make sense? This is the Western Wall Plaza, and this would be a third temple, and the mosque would remain there, and that was just one suggestion. It's interesting to think, even today, if you'd been the architect in charge of the Western Wall Plaza in 1967, you said, okay, what am I going to do to bring Jewish holiness or the sense of holiness to Jews who can visit for the first time in 2,000 years? That there was quite a certain critique about we should have had architectural competitions, we should have gone out to tender, we should have found out what we would build there or not build there. I understand the pressure, I don't want to sound critical, but we did the easiest option possible. We just raised the area we're saying and said, here we are, this is the holiest place in the Jewish world. Maybe that would have won the competition. Maybe that's what we should do with the site. But it's interesting to think that just because the site looks a certain way, even the site that we use as today the central place of Jewish prayer, didn't necessarily have to look that way. And this is just one suggestion I wanted to share with you. In terms of what it might look like, because we're going to go back in time, so what it might look like in the future, just because of time I won't read it, but if you ever want to see a fascinating vision for what the Temple Mount should look like in the future, you can turn to Theodor Herzl. Theodor Herzl, when he wrote his Alt Neuland in 1900, something like that, at the end of the 19th century, he talked about all kinds of... He predicted the light railway, by the way, in Jerusalem. That's one thing. He was 100 years ahead of the Israeli government. And really, there's an amazing description about the light railway in Jerusalem, but one of the things he talks about is the Temple Mount, and he talks... I'll just read one paragraph. They came directly from Jericho up to the top of the Mount of Olives with its wide views. Jerusalem and her hills were still sacred to all mankind, still bore the tokens of reverence bestowed upon her through the ages. But something had been added, new, vigorous, joyous life. The old city within the walls, as far as they could see from the mountaintop, had altered least. The Holy Sepulchre, the Mosque of Omar, and other domes and towers had remained the same. But many splendid new structures had been added. That magnificent new edifice was the Peace Palace. A vast calm brooded over the old city. In his ideal world, in his utopian novel, that none of the existing buildings are moved, but the temple has been rebuilt as the Peace Palace. It's one of the areas where he clearly goes out of his way not to say anything really serious, because when you read on a little bit further, he talks about it being on Mount Moriah. But if it's on Mount Moriah, then how can the other buildings still be there as well? It's a fact that those who have analysed his book, Alt Neuland, which is, again, you could do a whole talk just on Theodor Herzl's vision of what Israel would look like, is fascinating. But by the way, the next line, again, it's the view from the Mount of Olives, where Hebrew University is today. And the next line, I'll just read it because I didn't realize it was here. Outside the walls, the picture was altogether different. Modern sections intersected by electric street railways. It's amazing, really, if you think about it. But anyway, that's a little bit about his vision of Jerusalem. What I want to do is I want to go back in time, and we'll see how many leaps back in time we're going to have time for today. But we're going to go back in time to the buildings that we're most familiar with on the Temple Mount platform. And the one we're most familiar with, and really one of the great architectural wonders of the world, and one of the most, I guess, familiar wonders of the world, or the architectural world, is the Dome of the Rock. The Dome of the Rock sits at the centre of the, not physically at the centre, but sits prominently on the mountain. It's the oldest Muslim structure in the world. The Muslim period began in the 7th century. There's no building they built earlier than this. In the short time, this was built shortly after Muhammad's death. There's no other building in the world which is, goes back as in the Muslim world that is as long standing as the Dome of the Rock. And that's what perhaps, one of the, like as I said, one of the most familiar lands, landmarks in the world. So the building we see today was built in 692. That's the beginning of the Muslim period. Some people are familiar with what we call the early Muslim period in this country. The early Muslim period really began in 638 with the conquering of the land of Palestine by the Muslims. And a little bit later in the year 692, the building we see on the slide was built. Again, the Muslim name for it I'm not familiar with, though. I mean, I've read it, but I can't declaim it off the top of my voice. It's a Muslim name, but known as the Dome of the Rock. And so the question people want to ask, one of the first questions they ask, is why did they build the Dome of the Rock? Like what was it to them? And it stood to this very day, of course. It's one of two buildings, two very prominent buildings. The Dome of the Rock is probably the more important of those buildings, or the more historical of those buildings. And the question is, what is it to the Muslims? I grew up with a traditional answer that, as I learned to study more, it's more complex than the traditional answer I grew up with. It's probably the answer that most Muslims will give to you, and whether they know there's a more complex answer or not, I'm not sure. So some of you may know. What's the more traditional, or the first answer you often get, Celeste?
Muhammad. It's a place where Muhammad ascended.
Exactly. There's a tradition which comes out of the 17th chapter of the Quran. In the 17th surah, it says, glory be to him who carried his servant Muhammad by night from the holy sanctuary, which refers to Mecca, to the further sanctuary, the masjid, or the, in Hebrew, misgad, which is the mosque, to the misgad al-Aqsa, to the far-off mosque, the precincts of which we have blessed, that we might show him some of our signs. For indeed, when he got to the mosque, if you carry on reading the story, in this magical night journey, Muhammad ascended to heaven to return to earth to go back to Mecca. And that's basically, I think, to make a quiz of Muslims, and perhaps non-Muslims, about what is this building to you? Why do you have a building precisely where, and I'm not sure you'd ask the question this way, but if we go back in time far enough, precisely where the Jewish memory of a building holy to them was, the answer would be because this event happened on that site. And I think that's the normal answer we get. And I've looked into it, it's become more complicated than that. Not to say, of course, whether it happened or not is a matter of faith. But at what point did Muslims start to quote this as the primary story? It seems perhaps only much later in history. And this isn't about point scoring, it's about trying to figure out what was going in the mind of al-Malik, the Muslim caliph, al-Malik, when he built this in Jerusalem in 692. What was his intention then? If sometimes we impose stories on a site later on to give them more credence, then what was the original intention? And then it becomes more complicated. Assuming he got to Jerusalem and saw an empty platform, the question is, why would I want to build a building like this, one of the architectural geniuses of the world to this very day? What's my motivation for doing so? And some of the clues, in fact, are in the building itself. Because around, let me just go on one more slide. This is a picture in the inside of the building. The inside, this is the dome, underneath the Dome of the Rock. I know I've been inside the building. Jeremy, I think, will be able to remember it looked like this.
Yeah, I was seven.
Okay, right. Basically, where the marker is now, you can see this is the outside wall of the building. Is the battery running out already? This is the outside wall of the building. I do have new batteries, but I'm not going to waste time putting them in. This is the outside wall of the building. Inside the building, there's an octagonal shape. And then inside the octagonal shape, there's a circle. And over the circle, there's actually over the octagon, there's an inscription all the way around. It's an inscription over 100 meters, I believe, 180 meters, going all the way around the building. So if you see where the pointer is now, in the next slide, we're going to go on, and you see there's an inscription going all the way around the building. And the inscription says something fascinating. And it says something fascinating both from what it does say and from what it doesn't say. Because the inscription, the most important part of the inscription, says the following. I'm going the wrong way, hang on. Says the following, you read with me at the top. There is no God but God. Muhammad is his prophet. Jesus is also his prophet, but God has no son. He neither begets nor is begotten. And you can see the Arabic writing, some of the earliest Arabic writing in the world, going around the top of the outer arcade in Sidon. So now we have a clue, perhaps. By the way, in this entire inscription, which if we carry reading all the way round, what isn't mentioned, which you think might be mentioned in that inscription, if indeed that was the reason for building the Dome of the Rock? The ascension of Muhammad to heaven is not mentioned. And so therefore it seems, therefore, that what perhaps may be one of the motivations for building the Dome of the Rock, think about the religious world at the time, and reading the inscription, what perhaps might it be? Exactly, it's showing who has the religious superiority at the time. It actually, and we'll see in a second, if you come to Jerusalem, there is a building which has dominated the Jerusalem skyline for hundreds of centuries and is drawing a power towards Jerusalem unsurpassed by any other city in the world. So if Islam now has this city, Islam now needs to prove to its believers and to the world that in fact its message is the true message. So rather than place a story on Jerusalem, which is unfamiliar to most people, it seems more likely, and we're going to see further clues, that the building in some ways was a direct competition in some ways to the prominence of Christianity in Jerusalem. Again, this isn't delegitimizing the Muslim narrative that is their primary narrative today. It's just interesting to see how the narrative evolved perhaps as time went on as well. Perhaps this is a very famous Arab historian writing 300 years after the building was built. He says, "Is it not evidence that Abd al-Malik, seeing the greatness of the martyrium of the Holy Sepulchre just a few hundred meters away, and its magnificence, was moved, lest it should dazzle the minds of the Muslims, and hence erected above the rock the dome which is now seen there?" And it's almost like more proof that the dome became almost direct competition to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And now if you think about it, think about the architecture. What do the two buildings have in common? Many of you, even if you haven't been in them, you can see them from afar. The architecture is very same. They're a dome. It's called a martyrium, which is remembering. A martyrium isn't a martyr necessarily, but it's remembering an important event. It isn't a building that has a direction. If you think about the Dome of the Rock, that's what makes it very unusual in terms of places of worship. In fact, it wasn't meant to be a place of worship. It's meant to be a place of memory. It doesn't have a direction. It focuses you inwards on what happened inside. And in some ways, therefore, it's a competition to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Nate?
Was there anything standing in the Temple Mount from the period when the temple was destroyed until this mosque was built?
If we have time, we're going to get to that, because we're going to go backwards. We're going to see what was there. And when we have time, we're going to see what we're probably not going to have time as well. We'll see what happens. What's interesting, this is a bird's eye view of the Temple Mount today. Again, you can see that the two buildings, which are there, are tiny parts of the Temple Mount. This one building, which is not in the center of the Temple Mount, is what we know as the Dome of the Rock, and then the Al-Aqsa Mosque is the building which is over here, is the Al-Aqsa Mosque. There's one or two other buildings around the mountain as well, for sure, but in terms of central, this is not a building. This is a raised platform in the center of the mountain on which the Dome of the Rock, to get to the Dome of the Rock, you have to go up staircases, of which we'll talk about a little bit more later, because they're important, to get to the Dome of the Rock, which is in the middle there as well. Why I'm showing you this for now is there's a dome here. You can't see the inscription here, but it's called the Dome of the Ascension. And the Dome of the Ascension is a fascinating dome. It looks like this. It's just to the side of the Dome of the Rock. The Dome of the Rock would be to the right here. And the Dome of the Ascension is interesting because the Dome of the Ascension seems to have a very early tradition. It was built, the current dome is probably not more than about 1,000 years old, but we believe that it was built on the site of an earlier dome. It's a memorial to a particular event, which probably started to be associated with a mountain, again, about 1,000 years ago, I should say. It doesn't go before the Crusader period. If you have a dome called the Dome of the Ascension, you're building that dome to remember a particular religious memory. The religious memory you're building it to remember is the memory of Muhammad's ascension to heaven. You wouldn't need to build a dome remembering that memory. The big golden dome right next to it was built to make that, to remember that memory. Does that make sense? Like the fact that there's a small dome called the Dome of the Ascension seems to add weight to the idea that when that dome was initially built, the main narrative associated with the golden dome wasn't yet prominent in the Muslim mind. And as time went on, the narrative that we now think of as the primary narrative got actually switched to the Dome of the Rock, which hadn't been its primary purpose when it was initially built. You with me? I have so much more to say about it. I want to move back in time already. Geo.
This, so the current one is from actually, it's been rebuilt. This is, if I'm not wrong, from the Mamluk period, from the 1413 and 1400s, but we believe it was already there in the Crusader period, which is probably about the time that the tradition of Muhammad got associated with the Temple Mount. Because if, I won't go back to it, but if you go back to the slide about the quote from the Quran, what doesn't it mention in that quote? Jerusalem. It doesn't mention Jerusalem. So it's not clear. It says that Muhammad went to the far-off mosque in order to ascend to heaven, in order to come back down, in order to return to Mecca, but it doesn't mention it by name. So it may not have been obvious to the early Muslim believer that that tradition is actually was the tradition of the Temple Mount. Okay? Let's go back in time. One of the questions, and this might be to do with your question, one of the questions people ask, Nate, is if the Jewish temple was destroyed in the year 70, what happened in those 600 or so years? What was the Temple Mount during those 600 years? We know that clearly, and we're going to get to Herod shortly, we know that the temple that was destroyed by the Romans in the year 70 was a huge complex of buildings, some of which they didn't destroy, in fact, some of which remain to this very day. But assuming they destroyed a lot of it, like what was left? If I visited the Temple Mount in those 600 years, or perhaps we'd like to ask the question like this. If a Muslim came to Jerusalem in 638, when the Muslim world conquered Jerusalem, what would they have seen on the Temple Mount? What was remaining from the Jewish temple, which we'll talk about shortly, from Herod's time 600 years earlier? And the answer to the question is we really don't know. We really don't know. Partly it's confusing because I'm just going to give you the list, and those of you who are good historians will be able to fill in this list for me. Listen to all the people that ruled Jerusalem between this year and this year, in those nearly 600 years. Really, it's over 600 years because it's between the year 70 and 692 when the Dome of the Rock was built. Began with pagans. Then there was a brief rule of Jewish rule. Then pagans. Then Christians. Then an apostate Christian ruler, then Christian again, and just before the Muslims came in 638, who ruled Jerusalem very briefly for 14 years? Persians. Persians ruled then. Well done, Ben. And so for those 600 or 700 years, it's very confusing. We know, as I said, much of the Temple Mount compound was demolished, but what remained and what we don't know. There's a fascinating slide here from the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. This was one of the brief periods when there seemed to be Jewish independence in Jerusalem, one of two very brief periods. And one of the coins they issued fascinatingly has a picture of the temple on it, which has raised some historians to say that, in fact, there was an attempt to build the third temple during those years. Listen, there's another explanation why the temple is on the coin. What's the other explanation for why there's a temple on the coin? It's a memory. Exactly, it's a memory of something. So the question is it something that they wanted to build, or is it something that they did start? Is it an architectural plan for something they tried to build? And that's, again, we won't spend long in this period, but that's a piece of speculation. Another interesting, fascinating piece is, in any event, that period of Jewish independence was short-lived. For about 300 years, there was pagan rule over Jerusalem. And we're looking here at the southern wall of the Temple Mount. We're outside the walls of the Old City. Do some of you know it? But this is the wall of the Old City coming out from the southern wall of the Temple Mount. And look with me at the pointer. I'm going to do a close-up in a second. There's a gateway here, a closed gateway, but this is what's called the lintel. This is the top of the gateway. Do you see that there? Let's do a close-up. This is the lintel, where the pointer is now. This is the bottom left-hand of the picture is the top of the gateway. And three stones above it, there's a stone here with the arrow pointing at it where there's an inscription. If you look carefully, can you see the letters on the inscription? You might need to go closer if you're sitting further away, but when you're there, you can see it with your own eyes. There's an inscription. It's actually upside down. It's clear that it was a building block, which the Muslim authorities, at some point when they were doing repairs on the Temple Mount, placed there. And if we read the inscription, it says, to Titus Aelius Hadrianus, Antonius Augustus Pius, the father of the land, Pontifex Ordo, decreed by the Decurions. It's basically a victory plaque. We think it was probably the bottom of a statue placed to the emperor Antonius Pius, the son or the adopted son, I don't remember, of Hadrian, who was the person who put down the Bar Kokhba revolt. there's pilgrims who came to Jerusalem in the 300 years of one particular pilgrim called the Pilgrim of Bordeaux, who talks about seeing a statue of Antoninus Pius on the Temple Mount. So again, one or two clues. Perhaps there was a temple for a few years under the Bar Kokhba revolt. Later on, it seems to be a place of statues. The Roman Empire used it for statues on the Temple Mount. The fact that we found what seems to be the fact that we have a pilgrim's account who saw a statue of the emperor on the Temple Mount, and we found an inscription with the emperor's name on it being used to rebuild the outer walls of the Temple Mount, very clearly seems to be that perhaps it was taken from the base of the statue over there. Listen, the whole frustration behind this, of course, for an archaeologist is, what's the biggest frustration about this whole area? There's nowhere else in the world we want to know more about, and there's nowhere else in the world that we can do less archaeology than this particular place. So sometimes we have 600 years where we're trying to figure out what happened, and we don't have the archaeological tools. And then the last thing before we get on to Herod is that for 300 years before, or most of 300 years before the Muslims, there was a brief period where there was those 300 years of Christian rule, basically, before the Muslims came. And this map gives us a very real sense of what Jerusalem looked like for this 300 years. This is what road? Pardon? This is why you buy your talit and those other nice shops and those kinds of things. This is what Jerusalem looked like for most of those 300 years. It's a mosaic found underneath the floor of a church in Jordan, in Madaba, in Jordan. Has anyone seen it? Like with their own eyes? I saw it once. It's amazing. It's like the whole floor of the church. It's a really amazing thing. And it's clearly that for 300 years, the biggest building in Jerusalem was this building over here. What's this building? Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which today you go through some side door to get there, but clearly for 300 years, you came through a magnificent staircase to come into it. And we're left wondering, whoever drew this map, they must have been familiar, but we're left wondering, is this the Temple Mount over here? Is it so insignificant that it doesn't even appear? Or if it is there, is this all that was worth putting on the map? And it seems that for most of the Christian world over Jerusalem, even if there had been for a short period a temple under Bar Kokhba, even if there had been a period of Roman rule when statues, and perhaps even a temple to Jupiter had been there, by the time the Muslims came in the 600s, that this is the Jerusalem they saw, where the focus of attention in Jerusalem had changed, and whatever had been on the Temple Mount after the Roman destruction was no longer there. And one of the proofs of that is when the Muslims came, they didn't have to clear anything to start to build the Dome of the Rock. So it's kind of a 600-year gap, and we'd love to know more about what went on in Jerusalem for those 600 years, but we don't really know a whole lot. There's a fascinating interlude when one of the Roman Christian emperors allowed the Jews to rebuild their temple in the 300s. The problem is he was killed after 18 months. But it seems that Jews started to rebuild the temple. This isn't the Bar Kokhba revolt, this is 200 years later. The Bar Kokhba revolt was under pagan rule. Julian the Apostate was when the Roman Emperor was already a Christian empire. And he allowed the Jews to rebuild their temple. And there's all kinds of historical stories about gathering the wood and the stones and everything they need to rebuild their temples. And there's all kinds of different reasons about why we didn't go through with it. The primary one being that Julian was killed after 18 months in rule as well. Why did the Christians, unlike the Muslims, turn the focus of their attention away from the Temple Mount? Or let's put it like this. Why did they very demonstrably leave the Temple Mount empty? And the Temple Mount, remember, is associated with Jesus. There's many things that Jesus did as a Jew on the Temple Mount. Nearly everywhere where Jesus went in this country, a church is built to that memory. So the question is, okay, if you're building the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and you're moving the focus of the primary memory of Jesus' life, or rather his death, why in any place leave the Temple Mount bare? Why not build a church there? Why be so clear to leave it empty?
Geo? Testament to the fact that Jews are Muslims.
Yeah, fair. Geo knows his New Testament. He had a good Christian background. we'll read it together. The quote is taken from three of the Gospels. It's very clear. Not one stone, in Jesus' own words, not one stone shall be left here standing upon another that will not be thrown down. It was a prophecy. Again, a Christian believes the prophecy comes from the mouth of Jesus. Many historians will say the prophecy was written after the event had already happened. It doesn't make it such a prophecy, but it doesn't matter. In the Christian memory, the prophecy that the temple will be destroyed, it's actually more powerful for a Christian pilgrim coming to Jerusalem for hundreds of years before the Muslim conquest to go to the Temple Mount and see there's nothing here, exactly like Jesus prophesied. And that perhaps is probably the main reason why Christians left the Temple Mount empty. It's curious, again, I want to confuse you, when the Crusaders were here, In the 10th and 11th, in the 11th and 12th century, there was a brief period when they did build a church on the Temple Mount. So it was interesting to see, but in any case, they didn't do it in this period as well. You can see the second answer is the transfer of numerous traditions to the Church of the Resurrection, center of the world, burial of Adam, and other things which had been Jewish traditions now moved to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre as well. And now we get to Herod. So now we're going to go back in time and see what do we know about the Temple Mount during the time of what's called the Second Temple Period. What do we know about Jerusalem during the Second Temple Period? And the answer is we know a whole lot. I'm going to say something a little bit controversial. We know a whole lot, even though we haven't found one confirmed remain of the temple itself. The temple itself referring to this one building here. In the center of the picture here where the light is here. The temple compound is a huge area, but the temple itself, which is the building of white marble and golden crenellated top, we're yet to find one 100% confirmed remain from that. Now, there's very good reasons why. But obviously, in a world which is charged with politics, that fact can be used very, very strongly by those, perhaps, who claim today that there wasn't a temple 2,000 years ago. And that's a claim which is made. Again, I'm not here to do the political like debate as such, but I'm just telling you why you might hear that claim. You will say, of course Herod had a temple here 2,000 years ago. And they will say, well, show me one fragment, one conferred fragment from the temple itself. And they're right. From the temple itself, there isn't one conferred fragment. The circumstantial evidence of everything around it leads us to believe also that what was in the center, what the written record tells us was in the center, was also there as well. And there's plenty of circumstantial evidence from the area around it. The most important we're going to see a second is the remaining walls of the compound known as the Temple Mount, the most famous wall of which, of course, is the Western Wall. Where's this model from? Israel Museum, exactly. It's an Israel Museum. So how did they build this model? What were the main sources they used in terms of giving a sense of what did Herod's temple look like 2,000 years ago? Four main sources, I'm just listing them. We're not even going to look at them just because there isn't time. It's, of course, rabbinic writings, meaning mostly the Talmud. Has many very detailed evidence, not detailed evidence throughout, detailed records of what their memory of the temple was. Josephus, who was alive during the time that the temple stood. The New Testament, of course, again, it's not a book meant for history, but there's enough stories about Jesus walking through perhaps the colonnaded arch or turning over the tables and all kinds of, and teaching. He gave a shiur on the Temple Mount. I mean, he was Jewish, so that like there's no reason why he shouldn't have done these things. It gives a sense of what Jewish activities happened on the Temple Mount 2,000 years ago. And then the last thing, of course, is that the archaeological record. And again, the archaeological record may not be about the temple, the building in the center precisely, but there's plenty of archaeological record which confirms all the writings seem to confirm each other. This is one of the most famous ones. Many of you are familiar with this. Of course, for most of our history, we didn't know this. There's a very recent discovery in archaeological terms. It began where we're pointing now was first identified by Edward Robinson, archaeologist in the middle 19th century, American. And he saw, do you see there's some stones peeking out from the Temple Mount? 100 years later, with some confidence, we're able to build this picture here, this monumental staircase leading up to the Temple Mount. Do you know where this is? This is the corner between the Western Wall and the Southern Wall, in the area. And often it became, obviously it's politically charged because of the Jewish debate about liberal Jewish services and things like that. But for many years, by the way, they didn't think it was a staircase. What did they think it was for many years? What's underneath this area over here? It's actually a valley. The Temple Mount the mountain is now covered by these huge walls. There's a mountain somewhere underneath that. And they used to think this was a bridge going over the valley, like with arches. Do you see how the light is jumping? And only as time has gone by and we've done the archaeology have we realized that this is a monumental staircase coming down a little bit like that. And those pieces of evidence today, like we take them for granted, yeah, everyone knows Robinson's art, the piece of bat mitzvah's there. But it's like, the first time I was invited to the bat mitzvah, I literally walked around for hours, is that I never found the arch, but it's not there anymore, obviously the arch, but it's like, it's that kind of thing that we even throw out the name Robinson's arch, like, yeah, everyone knows it's an arch. And again, there's people here who aren't 100% sure what we're talking about, don't worry, like it's, I'm just making an assumption that many people do, but if you don't, I obviously don't mean that in any way judgmentally to those who don't. We found one or two inscriptions which are amazing inscriptions which also have parallels in all the different sources. There's an amazing inscription written in Greek No Gentile may enter beyond the dividing wall into the court around the holy place. Whoever is caught will be to blame for his subsequent death. There's one which is the fall. Too harsh, you didn't, yeah? which Josephus tells us that Gentiles weren't allowed within a certain area. The Talmud tells us that there were areas which, so they don't say there were signs. Josephus says he saw the sign, and why shouldn't he was with his own eyes, he was there. The Talmud tells us there were certain areas where certain people could go. They don't necessarily talk about a sign, and the New Testament also says in general terms there were certain areas. So to find a sign, it's like, at what point do, like, we can start to construct a very clear image of what Herod's temple may have looked like as well. Of course, the sign is in what language, maybe I said?
Greek.
Why would it not be, Jews spoke Aramaic, why would it not be in Aramaic? Exactly, it wasn't meant for Jews, so it's like, you can see, it's like the sense and the logic makes, there's a lot of logic there as well. Let's do this. We're going to finish with one last, because we're running out of time. I want to give you a few minutes break before we go on, and I think in some ways this is the most important. Give me another 5 minutes before we run over. The question many people want to ask is, so what was before Herod? Everyone learns and is taught that Herod built this, like, reconstructed the temple. But he didn't build the temple. He reconstructed something that was standing there beforehand. So in the same way we asked, what did the Muslims see when they came to Jerusalem? Or what did Herod... So now I'm going to ask the question is, what did Herod see when he came to Jerusalem? And here we're starting to get into much less certain territory about what was, and it's a strange term to use, but I'm going to call it, what did the first second temple look like? But it's a helpful term. Does that make sense? Because Herod built the second temple. He rebuilt the second temple. In fact, we know that he was so mistrusted by his own people when he said, listen, let's rebuild the temple. They were sure he was going to destroy it, not rebuild it. The Talmud tells us, amazing story, that they said, we don't believe you. And he actually gathered all the materials necessary for his rebuilding project before he destroyed what was standing there beforehand. So the question is, what was standing there beforehand? What did Herod see? And we're calling it the first second temple because the second temple period began about 300 years before Herod. And assuming that the same building that had been built by the Jews who built the second temple, the first one, when Herod came along and rebuilt it, the second temple, what did he see? And here there's just one or two tantalizing hints, and I'll finish with this, because next time you go to the Temple Mount, you'll look for them if you haven't seen before. One of the assumptions is that the, I'm colorblind, but what's this color, gray, brown, pink?
Brown.
All of those? Brown. the beige, like, it's one of those colors which is just cruel for colorblind people. The brown area is the extent of the Temple Mount today. What we believe is Herod's building of the Temple Mount. But there was a Temple Mount before Herod, using the same techniques that Herod built, in terms of making a flat area and having huge retaining walls. The Western Wall is the most famous one today around it. And what we think is that the first second temple was this yellowy-orange inside one, which is 500 cubits by 500 cubits. That's a measurement taken, I'm sure Meir's going to speak more about this, it's a measurement taken from the Mishnah. And we assume, you see, it could refer to one of two things. It could either refer to the first second temple, or it could refer to what?
First.
To the first temple, exactly. And so we're not sure. There's some assumption that the Maccabees actually already extended the temple slightly. That perhaps that they made a slight extension for this light blue area. And then it was Herod who more or less doubled the size of the temple. By the way, you can see that the wall that he touched less, in terms of he didn't extend it out, was the Eastern Wall. Why didn't he extend the Eastern Wall out any further? Exactly. It's in the Kidron Valley is there, one of the steepest valleys of Jerusalem. And so you can start to see that even his own ego was bound by geographical functions. What's the evidence, and I'll finish with this, what's the evidence for what he may have seen when he came to Jerusalem? Have a look where the pointer is there, and it says straight joint. Do you see that? Let me show you the next slide. This is the Eastern Wall of the Temple Mount. We're more familiar with the Western Wall because this is the area where we pray. The men have a section here under Wilson's Arch, and there's an area here, and this is Robinson's Arch. We're going to go to the Eastern Wall, which is outside or part of the walls of the Temple Mount. And if you go there today, you see this amazing thing. Do you see where the black arrow is? And I'll show you with a pointer as well. That there's a straight line up here. In fact, once upon a time, this was the edge. This was the southeast corner of the Temple Mount, and the Temple Mount at this point went inwards to the south. Does that make sense? That everything from here to here
was an extension, so the platform on top was extended to the south. And this joint here has no business in built. When you make buildings, you don't build a straight line like that. The buildings are this is running out, but the buildings are built with interlocking stones. And you find a straight line. Do you see the straight line going up here? Like this. This was once the corner. When we look beyond the corner, many of the stones beyond the corner are what we're familiar with as Herodian stones. Very specially crafted stone. Many of the stones before it are what we're familiar with as Hasmonean stones. We know them as Hashmonaim or Maccabee stones as well, seeming to indicate that here we have a very clear sense of one of the areas where Herod extended the Temple Mount. You can go and see it. It's exactly how it looks today. It's fascinating. It's an area which you're less familiar to visit because, well, actually, the area outside the Temple Mount here is what on the eastern side of the Temple Mount? Have you been there?
It's a cemetery.
It's a Muslim cemetery. And you might feel that you're alone. I mean, there's not very many tourists there. So if you go, maybe go with someone. It's a fascinating period to place a walk through, and you see that. And I'm going to show you one last piece of evidence before we're going to finish. But again, the minute we go back to the period of the first, second temple, in a way, we're going to finish a little bit before some of the material. But I'll be honest with you, once you go further back in time, it's going to become much harder for the historical mind to be able to show you what we know. I can tell you what the religious memory and the historical memory knows, but it's different from what the archaeological or the historical mind might know. So I want to show you one other thing. Any questions about that? Does that make sense in terms of what you're looking at? So one other fascinating piece of evidence, which I only learned recently actually, and I've seen it now as well, is there's a stair. Here. This is the bottom stair of the following staircase. There's a staircase here. The stones leading up this staircase are all fairly uniform. They're the stones. I'm going to have to jump around in the slides for a second. Hang on, I keep pressing the wrong thing. This staircase we're looking at is this staircase over here. Remember, this line over here is a raised platform. It's a current raised platform. You can see it's not a square platform, but it's a raised platform. You have to walk up the stairs in order to get to the Dome of the Rock. At the top of each of the staircases, there's arches that you walk through. They don't lead not into a building. They're freestanding arches. And this staircase over here is a little bit unusual because the bottom stair of this staircase, do you see now how the stones on this staircase are different from the other stones leading up here? And one of the theories has been, and it's been in one of the historical books I looked at, I've never seen this, but literally in the last 10 years, the Muslims raised the level of the platform on the Temple Mount. They repaved the area leading up to the stair. Previously, the stair had been slightly raised, but it had been like the first step. Right now, you can see it's kind of on ground level. And you could see just a few inches that this stone was engraved on its side as well, the side which is now covered up. Does that make sense? So like if you're walking to a staircase, now you just walk straight onto it. But previously, you take a little step up onto it, and you take a little step, you just look down at the little step you're taking up, you see that it's engraved. And the assumption, perhaps, or one of the theories, is that bottom stair over there is in fact this is what happens when Joel gets you a new computer. That bottom stair is in fact the top of the wall or the platform of the Temple Mount from before Herod. If you like, one of the only remainders of the first, second temple. Or the first, second temple platform. Because if it wasn't once a staircase, but it was the top of a long wall, but it was incorporated into a staircase, it gives us some sense, perhaps it may have been, the staircase has now been leveled. So the as you walk up to it, you walk flat onto the staircase. But if the pavement had been a little bit lower, and it was recorded as having indentations going down, that perhaps it had actually been once upon a time the top of a platform, which was the first, second temple. If it was part of the first, second temple, what's fascinating is that the space between that staircase and the eastern wall of the Temple Mount today is 500 cubits. Now, it's difficult to say that 100% because different people think cubits are different things. But 500 cubits is the measurement that Midot gives us, that the Talmud gives us. And 500 cubits is therefore, seems to be referring to the first, second temple and not to Solomon's temple. Does that make sense?
that though the first second temple could be based on Solomon's temple, that the Talmud itself seems to imply otherwise as well. So that we're not sure. It's fascinating in terms of, like, next time you go, or if you come with me, and you'll see that first step, how it sticks out from the other steps as well, and it just begs certain questions. I'll just mention one other thing. The last curiosity about it is that it's clear that this staircase, and only this staircase, was built before this platform, whereas all the other staircases were built at the same time as the platform, because all the other staircases are perfectly perpendicular to the platform. Do you see this staircase here? The platform here is not a 90 degree angle. None of the platforms ever, but the platform on which the Dome of Rock is. So this staircase here, for example, the bottom stair is at the same angle as the platform to which you're ascending. Does that make sense? But the bottom staircase here, do you see the platform here is a diagonal line, but the staircase remains not perfectly aligned with it, which seems to be that the platform was built and then the bottom stair was used from a pre-existing structure. It's the odd one out. All the other staircases, when you ascend up to the Dome of the Rock, are perfectly perpendicularly aligned. This one isn't. And so that bottom staircase, we said, seems to hint that it might be something else. And therefore, it's just one other piece of evidence. That's the first one. And this is the second one, of tangible evidence of what perhaps the first, second temple would have looked like, what Herod may have seen when he came to Jerusalem. I'm not going to go back further in time because, listen, there's plenty of archaeological evidence of things from Jerusalem in this time. We found pottery and we found jewelry from the first temple and the second temple period. What I've tried to concentrate on is, what do we really know? What do we really know? What can we see with our eyes in terms of what the temple looked like? And what did Solomon's, what did Herod's temple look like? What did the first, second temple look like? If we had more time, we'd look at what Solomon's temple looked like. And there, the truth is, I wouldn't be able to really show you anything. I can go into theories, but there's nothing I can really show you, so it's probably a good place to end. We'll take a couple of questions, we'll have a short break, and then we'll go from there. So that's...
For the new construction on this mount between the time of the destruction and the second temple, significant, but next to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, yeah, are all these, the capitals of all these Roman columns?
Yeah.
It's like a graveyard.
Yeah. I'll tell you what they mostly are. They're mostly columns from the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Al-Aqsa Mosque... Exactly, has been built, unlike the Dome of the Rock, which is the oldest Muslim extant building in the world, the Al-Aqsa Mosque has been built and rebuilt many, many times. And it was actually, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is the second building, we didn't really talk about it today, on the Temple Mount. It was actually two or even three times the width of what it was today, and it was filled with beautiful, beautiful columns inside it. And so some of those columns were not able to be used again, and those are the ones you see basically lying around when you go onto the Temple Mount as well. There's one theory that some of the wooden beams used in the Al-Aqsa Mosque today are beams from Herod's temple, but we'll save that for another time. But that's what we know as well. Gio?
What is inscribed on that stuff?
There's no inscription. Like Herod's stones are slightly inset. So it looks like some of those stones have been inscribed in... engraved so that, not with inscription, but like, if you're standing from afar, and this was the top stone of a large wall, it would be a beautiful wall. Each stone would be slightly offset from the one next, or, you know what I mean, like a margin would be around each stone. You can't see those margins today because the staircase has been raised, illegally I should say, by the Muslim authorities who I don't want to get into it, but that also make many changes to the Temple Mount, which also in contravention of the status quo agreement. Last question, otherwise we'll finish. Good. That's the history.